Blog Talk Radio. every day.
And welcome, everybody, to the Dragon's Lair. Sorry for that little delay right at the beginning there. I'm using two computers because of issues with either the internet or Blog Talk or my browser. One of the three or all three or some combination thereof. So really hard to do a perfect show anymore on Blog Talk Radio for whatever reason. I get these messages here, too, today that they're having problems with dropouts on the on the calls. And I don't know if that means for the host or the people calling in or just what. But anyway, hopefully this show will go okay. And when you listen to it in the archives, hopefully there will not be any dropouts. So anyway, tonight's topic will be a continuance of my series of shows on Texas. And this one is part two. Please go to the Blog Talk Radio show page for details. Hopefully Renegade Broadcasting will pick this show up as well. You'll be able to hear it there, and there should be details there as well. For the record, today is September 7th, 2013, on our screwed-up Christian calendar. The sun is at 14 degrees Virgo. Again, I do not have a personal website or blog. If you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com, and that's M-A-G-U-S. _18@geocities.com. You can subscribe to my e-list. Just send me an email saying subscribe, or just write me. I can't guarantee I can get to all of my emails. And I should be sending out some soon. There will be no calls tonight. The cat is underneath the table here. I've been trying to get her out from under it for a while. I don't know what she's doing under there, but I'm afraid she's going to hit the power button on my power strip and all my power goes out. So the dog is in the other room. So anyway, I will continue with this from the last show, and I'll be talking tonight about the continuation of that article, and I will also play some more audio from some video on a documentary about the Comanche Indians and the Texas Rangers. And you'll get to learn a little bit about the Indians that roamed the Texas Plains. They were the most fierce warriors of all of the North American Indians. And as I mentioned before, I believe it's in the second video, you will be able to hear the same guy speak who wrote that article on how American Indians feel about immigration that Kyle read on his show. I won't reread that, but and I don't know which show that was offhand. But without further ado, let me go ahead and play these two. And each one is approximately 10 minutes.
The story of the Comanche warrior begins here and will end here, in the rugged canyons, the open plains, and wooded hills that stretch from what is now Kansas to central Texas. It's an area of nearly 20,000 square miles, teeming with buffalo, deer, and antelope, one of the most fertile hunting grounds in North America. It's a rich land that satisfies the needs of these proud people. At first, the Comanche wander through these southern plains on foot, as nomadic hunters, following the plentiful game. Then, in the late 17th century, the Comanche first encounter strange and powerful animals. Herds of mustangs, left behind by Spanish conquistadors. These will transform the Comanche from nomads the legendary warriors.
Well, the Comanche
to me, always could handle the horse. That's just part of us.
And the Comanche, it seems, was just a suited individual for the horse. The Comanches, on the average, were about 5'6". They were, you know, broad and deep in the chest. They had heavy muscles. In my mind, they were kind of like the perfect jockey.
I think the secret of Comanche power is horsepower.
Even though other tribes learn to use the horse with great skill, the Comanche discover they have an almost supernatural affinity with the horse, and they become powerful equestrians.
Within a generation after they discovered the horse, after they just saw this animal for the first time, the Comanches developed the reputation of being the finest horse breeders in the Southwest.
They breed the Mustangs to be small, fast, and tough. The herds are nurtured, cared for, and defended. With plenty of strong horses, the Comanche are highly mobile. And on the backs of their prized Mustangs, Comanche hunters can overtake large herds of buffalo roaming the plain.
The buffalo was the prize because the plains people had learned to use the buffalo in 52 different ways. So the buffalo meant, it meant life.
This was the richest game area in North America because of the buffalo primarily. This is one thing that made the Comanches so powerful, because they could get their food much, much easier than other plains tribes.
Mobile and efficient hunters, the Comanche territory grows. And with this mobility comes the necessity to keep other tribes out of their hunting grounds. To survive, the Comanche must fight. And they fight frequently with their neighbors, the Apache, the Kiowa, and the Ute. In fact, the name Comanche comes from the Ute word, Komat, meaning those who are against us.
If you could really understand one thing about the Comanches, is that they were on the offensive. That's how that they worked. They struck and they raided, and no one dared, you know, to enter their territory.
A man's value to the tribe becomes his value as a warrior.
A warrior is somebody who provides for the people, the ability to protect, to provide, and to preserve your people. That's what a warrior is, not just a killer.
A man got prestige by his valor. Courage was their supreme virtue.
With an ever-growing territory and a culture based on the cult of the warrior, the Comanche build themselves into the fiercest, most tenacious warrior hunters in North America.
War was not a situation with them, it was a continual state of mind.
Wherever the war took us, that's where we were.
The Comanche, who never seem to have numbered more than 12,000, live in small family groups called bands, enabling them to spread out over a larger area, not having to compete for food and water, but still capable to come together in times of war.
There were several major bands and many, many subdivisions from the major bands. Quahadas, that's the antelope eaters. Yaparacas, Lakosaracas. The Noconis. They were those who wandered over the plains, the Penataka. In fact, they were the most southern band.
Each band has its own leaders, and all band leaders serve equally. There is no one great Comanche chief.
A Comanche leader evolved over a period of time with superior skills and superior intelligence. There was no campaigning. In fact, that would ensure that you wouldn't become a leader. Not happen.
The Comanche system of small bands, leaders chosen through valor, and their skills in defending their land works brilliantly. The tribe is not only existing, they are flourishing.
Comanches had developed such a reputation for efficiency in battle and in warfare that in spite of the fact that there were relatively very few of them, they controlled the largest hunting empire in the history of this continent.
By the early 1800s, Comanche warriors have ruthlessly driven off all other tribes who dare to invade their vast hunting grounds. But a strange new tribe of white men, calling themselves Texans, begin to crowd Comanche territory. And these tough frontiersmen will prove to be a more than worthy enemy against the war-hardened Comanche. Learns and adapts to the Comanche way of war. His first revelation is that the Rangers must go on the offensive. And with their new Colt six-shot revolvers, the Rangers pack an indisputable advantage.
Just like two champions who are kind of going for the title fight. But this title fight goes on round after round, battle after battle, raid after raid, and so forth.
The Texas Ranger adapting this sort of guerrilla warfare, plus his practiced accuracy with his firearm, made the Texas Rangers the most powerful force that the Comanche ever faced.
But they caught a Comanche camp. Jack Hayes wiped them out, and with no particular attention to age or sex. They killed them all if they could get them. On the other hand, this is exactly the way the Comanches fought the whites.
In 1846, the United States annexes Texas and inherits the Rangers' Comanche problem. Within 2 years, federal troops are building a string of forts across the Great Plains, and more settlers arrive in droves. But ironically, it's not pistols, but a pestilence that wreaks the most havoc on the Comanche. First smallpox, and then in 1849, a cholera epidemic kills hundreds of Comanches.
We do not know the exact number of losses. We know they were terrible. The tribes were absolutely decimated.
Weak and vulnerable, some Comanche bands agree to move onto a Texas reservation. But Texans want the Comanche out once and for all. And in 1859, many in the tribe are forced onto a federal reservation in what will eventually become Oklahoma.
And they ran us out of Texas into Oklahoma. They killed our men, women, and children.
The change of riding with the wind to being caged was just a pathetic spectacle.
They are concerned that their entire way of life is going away. That's what, to them, they are fighting for.
Some Comanche bands resist moving to the reservation. With the holdouts is a 13-year-old Quahada Comanche named Quanah. Quanah's father is a war chief, and his mother is a white female captive. Although he is barely a man, Quanah already shows the signs of intelligence, ferocity, and commitment of a Comanche leader.
Okay, that was part one. And actually, that same Comanche that I was discussing before I played that was in the talking in part one as well. He was the one that's saying that a Comanche without a horse was a pathetic creature. I think he talks more in part two, and that's why I said what I said. So anyway, here is part two.
The U.S. government had finally decided that it's time that we do something to control the situation.
On the Comanche side, the most outstanding leader is the son of a great war chief and the first captive white girl. He now calls himself Quanah Parker.
He was very brave, and he proved himself to be a very strong Comanche fighter.
Quanah Parker is ruthless, brilliant, and he meets his match in the new commander of the U.S. 4th Cavalry, Lieutenant Colonel Ranald McKenzie.
Not glamorous, not dynamic, not like Custer, but he was one that got things done, and he came to the West.
Ranald Slidell McKenzie, in my opinion, was the last great American cavalry leader in the West. McKenzie was the
cavalry leader who finally did it for the Comanches. He, along with others, had learned to do away with sabers, cold camps, no bugle calls, pursue. This was perfect anti-guerrilla warfare.
And Mackenzie's tenacity is not the only problem confronting the Comanche. In 1871, the rotting carcasses of slaughtered buffaloes start appearing all over Comancheria. The American taste for fashionable buffalo hide coats and the use of buffalo leather for machinery belting is driving the herds to extinction. The Comanche staff of life is no more.
The greatest threat to them, believe it or not, isn't even the American military. It is the bison hunters.
The primary weapon that the buffalo hunters used was the 50 caliber sharps, which was a very powerful weapon that could easily bring down a buffalo at a great distance. One individual could kill 100 or more buffalo a day, every day, for months at a time.
Hundreds, thousands of buffalo are literally killed every day. During this time period, the buffalo being killed is killing the source of life, the source of everything that the Comanche are.
Their whole universe was beginning to collapse by this time.
Outgunned by the buffalo hunters, pursued by a lieutenant colonel who fought like a Comanche, Quanah leads his Quahada band and their last great herd of Comanche ponies back to the one place they believe they can hold off the U.S. cavalry and return to their old Comanche ways.
It had gotten to a point that Mackenzie was not going to give up. And always, as they began to do this, as they pursued the Comanche would literally fall off the earth because where did they go?
From a great distance, if you looked across the plains, it was hard to note that there actually was a canyon there. And the canyon was one of the great assets to many Comanches because it was a protection in winter. It was also a protection in warfare. The Comanches could hide many horses, thousands of horses, in that area.
This is really kind of an oasis, a sanctuary. I mean, look at it. Buffalo grazed here, and nobody could find them. That was this place.
It was hard to find. It was a great hangout, a great place to hide.
Here in Palo Duro Canyon, in the heart of the last Comanche hunting grounds, Quanah Parker and his remaining warriors hope to evade Mackenzie's relentless cavalry. If not, Quanah and his warriors vow to die fighting, like Comanches. In 1874, the last Comanches to reject life on a reservation are being pursued relentlessly by the U.S. cavalry.
The Indians could not stop. They could not stop to hunt. Women and babies died. They were pushed on. They just couldn't stop because there's always a cavalry troop on them. The Comanches were really in bad shape to the point where there was only one effective war band left, and that was the Quahuaranda.
The Quahuaranda war chief is Quanah Parker. He and Cavalry Commander Colonel Ranald Mackenzie have been playing cat and mouse for more than 2 years.
Mackenzie could never really catch a Quanah Parker.
In the Texas Panhandle, Palo Duro Canyon is the last great sanctuary of the Comanche. Palo Duro is unknown to the American troops, and the Comanche have been coming here for generations, and they know where to hide within its rugged, inaccessible canyons. Quanah Parker believes that this is the one place on Earth where he will be able to elude Lieutenant Colonel Mackenzie and his 4th Cavalry.
They came here to seek the face of the Great Spirit for endurance to continue and to start a beginning of a new lifestyle.
The cavalry has control of the camp, and Mackenzie orders his men to destroy the supplies, the food, the teepee. And then Mackenzie orders his men to shoot the entire Comanche herd. More than 1,400 horses are shot dead in Palo Duro Canyon.
This seems like a very brutal type of act, but they were war material just the same as the weapons and food he found here.
But to the Comanche, the horse is more than just war material. It is the lifeblood of their tribe.
That is the most pivotal event, I think, in Comanche history. Because after that, they're no longer who they were in the past. They are no longer lords of the plains, the greatest horsemen, the greatest warriors, perhaps, in the world. And after that battle, they are not that anymore.
The Comanche on foot is a pitiable creature. He can't fight. He can't hunt. He can't feed his family. He can't do anything.
The Comanche try to regroup and rearm and to find fresh horses. They make it through one more winter, but life is too difficult, and the cavalry knows it.
Finally, they send out people with the word, come in or we'll kill you all. A few hundred, I think a total of about maybe 1,000 Comanches all left. The Indians, as a independent people, were all finished.
On the 2nd of June, 1875, Quanah Parker and about 400 Comanche diehards surrendered to the U.S. government at Fort Sill in southwestern Oklahoma.
I don't know that they officially surrendered, but they came into Fort Sill because of the extermination policies. And for sake of survival, this was the only place that they could come.
This was essentially a tragedy. You look for good guys and bad guys, I think you're on a false trail. What you had was two peoples in collision, and I think it was inevitable if they ever came into contact with each other that they would not be able to live with each other in peace.
Despite the fact that the Comanche themselves never chose him, Quanah Parker is named Chief of the Comanche Nation by the U.S. government and remains so until his death in 1911. He is buried alongside his mother, Cynthia Ann Parker.
He felt, rightly or wrongly, but the only way that the people would survive was they had to walk the white man's road.
In a way, he escorted the Comanche Nation into the 20th century.
In the 20th century, the Comanche people may follow the white man's road, but they never lose the soul of the Comanche warrior. During World War II, they again rise to the level of their ancestors. On D-Day, June 6, 1944, a company of Comanches are among the troops that land on Utah Beach. Like the Navajo code talkers fighting in the Pacific, the Comanche soldiers use their own undocumented language as a code that the Germans cannot crack. Today, the spirit of the Comanche warrior lives on, as Comanches find themselves on the front line of another war, fighting for a country that once tried to exterminate them.
The short answer is, Comanches are good fighters. It calls forth an essence of being. It calls forth the raison d'être, the reason for why I'm here, is to fight.
Past history has only done the Comanches honor. And it's a wonderful privilege to be a Comanche.
Oh, I am so proud. Everywhere I go, you know, I tell them I'm Comanche. Ah, hey, na, na, hey, ne, ah, hey, ah, hey, ah, hey, I know, ah, hey, ne, ne. Hey, ne, na, hi, yo, ah, hey, ne, ne. Suvika.
Okay, I'm back. Yeah, he was throughout the whole documentary there, and as you can tell, that documentary was called, probably the whoever did it had to sort out the commercials. And at some point, I'll do more on the Comanche War, and at a later time. And the there's also a movie that came out in the 1950s called Comanche that is, I think, worth seeing. If I remember correctly, it is about Quanah Parker, who, as you just learned from that documentary, was half white, half Comanche. I actually kind of find that rather interesting when you consider the article that I've been referring to. You know, the I forgot this guy's name, this Comanche Indian who wrote it. He stated in that article that he saw in the white man a kindred spirit. And, of course, he also made the comment that white man has lost that spirit. So I think that's certainly some advice that we can learn from what he had to say. And I think that was certainly a very good observation. And most of my audience are already well aware of that. But in case some of you who may be catching this for the first time and are not familiar with some of my previous shows or Renegade Broadcasting Network, that's a little tidbit of information there. Also, too, before I continue on, instead of looking for my books in storage, which would really be time-consuming and this time of year is really miserable with the heat combined with the humidity, that's one of the worst things about being in Texas, but that's the whole Southeast United States, you know, all the way from Texas to the Atlantic, and, you know, the whole South is very humid, so it's not just Texas, and actually, the further west you go in Texas, the drier it gets. West Texas is almost semi-desert, not actually desert, it's considered semi-desert, some term along that line. Now, I just went ahead and just ordered some used books off of eBay. They were really cheap, and there's one I've still yet to receive, but I've got some interesting information out of these books that I'll be passing on at a later point. And just FYI, as we go along, the shows will get more detailed, and I will get into some real specifics about certain topics. And, of course, all of this is not completely as important as some of the rest of it. But if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to do it right. And I'm a Texas history buff. I learned Texas history very early in my life, and I know it very well. There are some who know more than I, but I don't do it for a living. And so I periodically have to keep coming back to it like I'm doing right now. And each time I do, I have to refresh my memory some. If it wasn't for the fact that I have to earn a living, I would probably write a book. But anyway, that's the way it goes. Now, I mentioned, too, that article I was reading last week about some mistakes in it. And the author, and I'll go ahead and give you the name, was Ben Klassen. Some of you may have already figured that out. That came from the White Man's Bible. And that section of it is called The War with Mexico, 1846 through 48, An Unfinished War. Now, he did a lot of great work, but it wasn't perfect. And, what I read last time and what I will continue this time, you know, it's just an overview. He didn't get into a lot of details. But again, there were some mistakes. One of the mistakes I need to correct from the first show was the acquisition of the Oregon Territory. The Oregon Territory did not comprise any a part of California. It was Washington State, Oregon, Idaho, and part of Montana. For some reason, he had Northern California included in this description of what was acquired. That's not the case. All of California was part of the Mexican cession that the United States acquired after the war with Mexico. So, anyway, I'm going to go ahead and get on back to that article. And, by the way, any of you who are not familiar with Ben Klassen in the White Man's Bible, that was He was involved with the creativity movement, which was an atheistic movement, by the way. Maxine Dietrich, high priestess of the Joy of Satan, and the owner of the Joy of Satan website, etc. She came out of the creativity movement prior to becoming and creating the Joy of Satan. She is a former atheist as well. And, by the way, she is a very, very good professional astrologer. She's my age, approximately. I don't know which one of us is older, but I think she's professionally licensed as an astrologer. And she probably has about, maybe 8 to 10 more years experience at doing it, and she's been doing it professionally, whereas I never have done it professionally. So anyway, I don't want to drift too much on the subject, but I just thought I would mention that. So anyway, let me wrap this up. Pick up about where we left off here. You know, this was about President Polk. And it says, Polk, one of the greatest. It says, we, the white race, should therefore proudly give our due credit and honor to President James Polk, who did more in 2 years, actually it was his whole term, to expand the territory of for the expansion of the white race than any other president in history. This despite the fact that practically all other politicians of his decade were stupidly enmeshed in a mad hysteria about slavery, to the point where practically all opportunity for positive action was next to impossible. Our school children have not been told the full story of this glorious chapter in the history of the white race, probably for that reason, because it was the most constructive and productive war in American history. The Jewish writers have downgraded Polk and the Mexican War as an insignificant part of our history. Now, I have mentioned, just interjecting here, I've mentioned President Polk and when I called in to the show of another host that is no longer with Renegade Broadcasting, and I mentioned him briefly about one of the things he had done in relation to banking and the currency. And I'll cover it a little bit more in depth as part of this series. There's just like this, this paragraph I just read. You know, ultimately, this is not just Texas here. This is the whole period of American history at that time. And it's very important. And you'll understand more as we go along. Back to the Mexican War. The Mexican War was a glorious victory. It says, instead, the Jews keep rehashing the Civil War, the nostalgia of it all, the colorful generals, and so on, ad nauseum. The fact that the Mexican War was a most constructive and productive war in the Civil War, a terrible, ghastly blunder perpetrated by the Jews themselves, is never pointed out. When they refer to the Mexican War at all, they portray it as one of a big bully, the U.S. taking advantage of a weaker neighbor. Well, the Mexican resources surpassed the U.S. That's the title of this section. It says, this too is a blatant lie. In 1846, Mexico had a population at least equal to the U.S. It had as large a territory under its domain. Its capital of Mexico City had a population of 200,000, more than four times the population of Washington, D.C. Mexico's history dated back to 1519, a good 300 years before the Anglos of the North even got started on their road to manifest destiny. Furthermore, at great disadvantage, the Americans had to fight this war on enemy territory far from home, with greatly overextended supply lines at a time and place where there were still no railroads, no telegraph lines, and when transportation and communications were still extremely slow and difficult in every engagement, in every encounter, in every battle. The Americans were outnumbered in manpower and outgunned in numbers of cannon and artillery. Any battle they would have lost on Mexican territory would have undoubtedly have meant the total slaughter of the American forces and the defeat of the United States, I will add. So it was hardly a war of unequals, as the distorted Jewish history books would have us believe. Now he goes on to discuss the superiority of the white race over the mongrels. It says, yet in every battle the Americans triumphed over the Mexicans, even when they were outnumbered 5-1, as they often were, Why do they triumph? The answer is in our genes, in the superior intelligence and fighting abilities of the white race over the other races, the mestizos, the mixed breeds, and the Indians. Let us never forget this. There are many other lessons we can learn from this glorious chapter of our history if we want to learn from history. And by the way, I will have a comment coming up at a later point. It may be in this show, we'll see, where another historian makes a very interesting comparison of the Mexican mestizos with the Anglo-Americans. Now, this next section is called What We Can Learn from the Mexican War. The most obvious and important lesson we must learn is that America, as every other country, empire, or civilization, was built by conquest. It was by force of battle, by spilling blood, by conquering the enemy that the white man forcibly took the land from the Indians or the Mexicans and even won their independence from the British. Let me relight this cigarette. It says, we of the creativity movement regard the wars against the Indians and the Mexicans as of far greater significance than the war of the American Revolution against England. After all, Canada has prospered equally well, although it never formally broke away from England. Its smaller population is solely due to the fact that only its southern fringes lie in a hospitable climate. You might want to keep that in mind, any of you who are thinking of North Dakota. Number three, if the Mexican War of pushing back the races, the mud races, and settling it with white people was so productive in the past and was the American way, why scrap a winning formula? Now, let me interject something. I really don't care to use that term mud races. You know, I don't want to get my account, I don't want to get this network deleted by using terminology like that, okay? But I'm just reading what it said right here, all right? So, to make sure that we do not get our accounts deleted. Okay, back to the article. Why not apply the same successful program to the rest of the land areas of the world, not just for the U.S., but for the white race as a whole? We of the creativity movement propose that this is exactly what we not only can do but must do if we are to survive. We have the intelligence, we have the power, and nature has given us the natural right to do so. In its credo, the creativity movement also furnishes us not only with the moral right to do so, but also the moral obligation to do so. Let me clear my throat. Number four. For those insipid bleeding hearts whose minds have been perverted by Jewish propaganda, we throw down this challenge. If you really believe that the white man was wrong in conquering America, if you don't believe in the American way, why don't you set an example of demonstrating your convictions by deeds? Give your property back to a Mexican or an Indian, renounce your American citizenship, and go crawl into a hole and die. That's the bottom line of your idiotic conclusions, whether you know it or not. We of the creativity movement, this is number five, take the contrary position. We take a position that both nature and history have taught from time immemorial, and that is land and race are everything. Land and territory are worth fighting for and dying for. Land is essential to the life and the preservation of our race. The survival, expansion, and advancement of race is the most vital goal in our existence. We of the creativity movement believe not only in expanding American territory, as did our glorious ancestors of 1846 through 48, but of following the same great American way of expanding the living area of the white race all over the world until the white race inhabits every hospitable square mile on the face of the earth. Well, I don't personally think that's realistic, nor do I think it's, I don't think it was realistic when he wrote this, and I don't think it's realistic now. And I think we'll be lucky to salvage most of our country. You know, we should avoid giving up hardly any of it. And so we need to keep that in mind. There may be places that we will have to give up, but so be it. I'm not going to get into that further here on this show. What we can learn from the Mexican War about dealing with our enemies. And this is using the Mexican War as an example. And that's why I'm reading this, really. because it really doesn't have a lot to do with the subject of Texas itself, but it does have, it is related in the sense of why this is important. Number one, the war, first of all, between the Texans and the Mexicans, and 10 years later, between the United States and the Mexicans, was first and foremost a racial war. It was a war of racial hatred between the inferior mongrel Mexicans and the healthy expansion of the white race. Now, let me interject something here, too, and I'll get to this at a later point. At the time of the Texas Revolution, there was a debate issues between whether to stay part of Mexico or to leave and eventually become part of the United States, now, which really that's almost three separate issues. But we'll just concentrate on leaving Mexico or remaining in Mexico. There were some Mexicans in the Texas Revolution. There were people who opposed the government of Mexico and Santa Anna, who had made himself a dictator. For a brief period of time after Texas won its independence, there was a period of what could be called multiculturalism. However, as the inevitable would be, as we all know, eventually that became a problem. And as time went on, the Mexicans got shoved aside, and Texas became basically an Anglo republic. And it really wasn't that long. But there was a period where that did happen. And out of that time period, there are some things about Texas that became part of our culture today, such as Tex-Mex food. And I'll mention this. When I say Tex-Mex food, most of you know it as Mexican food. Well, that's not correct. Let me tell you this. Go down to Mexico City, try ordering enchiladas, and see what happens. They will probably look at you like, what the hell are you talking about? All right. That is Tex-Mex. Okay. And by the way, Taco Bell is a very poor example of what Tex-Mex food is. It's hard to get really good Tex-Mex out of the state of Texas. With good reason. But anyway, and one more little thing on that subject. We've all been to a restaurant and we've all seen on the menu fajitas. Well, fajitas are a cut of beef. And if you look on your menu, you'll see beef fajitas or chicken fajitas. Well, there's no such thing as chicken fajitas. All right, that was some restaurant invention of the 80s, probably created by some Jew, just some way to try to make money. Grilled chicken strips or breast is not a cut of beef. Okay, the only fajitas are beef, period. Now, I've gone to restaurants before, even here in Houston. Of course, they weren't Tex-Mex restaurants. And I'd tell them I'd want an order of fajitas, whatever size, whatever type of order. They would say chicken or beef. And I'd say, there's no such thing as chicken. And they say, yeah, it's right there on the menu. I said, fajitas are a cut of beef. And they would look at me like, what the hell are you talking about? See, people have become so dumbed down. And even in our own state, there are people who do not know this, unfortunately. So we've got to work on that somehow. Restore our culture. Number two, the Mexicans hated the white race because they felt inferior and because they actually were and are inferior. Now, I don't like to go around talking about, okay, well, one race is better than the other, but I don't have any issue with this on saying that about the Mexicans. The Mexicans are truly a mongrel race. They are part Spanish, part Native Indian, part black, from two sources. Mexico absorbed its slave population. It outlawed slavery, and it allowed the blacks to remain there. But they interbred with the mestizos. So most mestizos are also part black. Additionally, there were many Spanish who came here who were not full Spanish. They were part Moors from the conquering that occurred over in the other hemisphere. And as you know, the Moors were part black. Number three, the Mexicans still hate us with the same fierce intensity as they did 100 or 200 years ago, and they always will. The reason is the same as to why the blacks and the other races of the world hate us. They feel inferior and threatened in both for good reasons. Number four, when Santa Ana won a military victory at the Alamo by means of sheer numbers, their hatred and cruelty knew no bounds. Playing the ominous Degüello, they not only massacred every soldier in the Alamo, but even then their fury knew no bounds. They hacked, stabbed, and mutilated the dead bodies for an hour afterwards, and even went so berserk as to shoot a number of their own men, though not a single American was still alive. Again, when Santa Anna defeated Colonel Fannin's 400 men at Coleto Creek, it says Goliad. Goliad is not where they were, the battle actually occurred. Those that were taken prisoner were then mercilessly shot in the back to the last man. Actually, that's not true. Some of them escaped. And he has in parentheses here, except those that managed to escape. With Texas wide open, Santa Anna then systematically set about killing every white settler in their path. Or at least he tried to. I don't think he killed that many. Most of the ones that he killed were isolated incidents of people who were not able to get away or during the actual battles. Until Santa Anna was trapped and defeated by Sam Houston at San Jacinto. The ominous lesson is this. If and when the Mexicans or the blacks or any other race has the power over us to do so, they will mercilessly slaughter the white race. They hate the hatred they have for the white race, aggravated by worldwide Jewish propaganda, is irreconcilable, just as the issue between the pioneer mother and the rattlesnake. Number five, never give your enemy a second chance. If Sam Houston, after defeating Santa Anna at San Jacinto in 1836, had not parleyed with Santa Anna, had not negotiated, had not trusted Santa Anna to keep his bargain, but had hanged him instead, and he had plenty of moral grounds for doing this after the Battle of the Alamo and the massacre at Goliad, then he would have saved the Americans and the white race many, many lives. Santa Anna would not have been around to rally the Mexican forces and kill thousands of Americans 10 years later. Similarly, if General Taylor had utterly destroyed the Mexican forces at Palo Alto and Resaca de Palma when he defeated them, he would not have had to fight some of the same survivors at Monterey and Buena Vista again. Similarly, if General Winfield Scott, who was otherwise a brilliant military strategist, would not have stopped to parley and negotiate peace with Santa Anna when he had defeated the Mexican army at the entrance to Mexico City, he would not have had to fight Santa Anna all over again 2 weeks later at a tremendous cost of lives. Totally destroy the enemy. The conclusion we should learn from all these experiences and thousands of other battles the white man has fought is this. When you have your enemy at bay, utterly destroy him while you have the opportunity, so he will never be able to come back and fight again. Don't trust him. Don't negotiate. Don't be charitable. Don't be chivalrous. Don't be magnanimous or big-hearted. Just utterly destroy them. The next section here. Heroic group. In the war against the Mexicans, there is one group of heroic men in the epic of the Southwest that deserves our particular mention, and I read part of this last time, but I'm going to read it again. Because of their tenacity, their bravery, and especially their dedication to the survival and expansion of the white race, we point out with pride that gallant cadre of white men, the Texas Rangers. They were rough, relentless, and untiring in waging war, pushing back and tracking down the Mexican and Indian marauders that tried to kill and drive out the early Texas settlers, as well as the war itself. Tough spearhead. That's what this next one is called. Whereas we do not have the space here to give even a cursory history of this elite band of lawmen, I want to give them their just due in making it possible for the white men and their families to first of all settle and secondly maintain their tenuous toehold on the precious soil they had won. When the Mexican War finally came to the mongrelized Mexicans in their place, it was the hardcore of former Texas Rangers that were the shock troops in practically every battle and every heroic victory, all the way from Matamoros to the halls of Montezuma. The relatively small force of 6 companies of Texas Rangers made a huge difference. I don't think I actually read that part. Strictly, no nonsense. When the war was over, the frontier of Texas still remained under savage assault from the calcitrant Mexican mongrels and their ancestral kinsmen, the savage Indians. Singly and in collaboration with each other, both the Mexicans and the Plains Indians continued their murderous raids on the Texas settlers for decades after the Mexican War was over. Actually, I don't really think that was quite true about the collusion between them. The Mexicans and the Indians hated each other. And one of the reasons the Anglos were invited into Texas in the first place was to tame the Indian that the Mexicans were not capable of doing. And I will go into that at a later point. Let me clear my throat. Okay. It says, especially the tenacious among the Indian tribes were the fierce Comanches and the Cherokees. The Cherokees were not as fierce. I'll get into this at a later point. The Comanches were clearly the most fierce on the plains. There was a war with Cherokees in Texas, okay? But the Cherokee had been moved from mainly northern Georgia, part of Tennessee, and part of North Carolina, over to the territory of what is now today the state of Oklahoma. This original idea was from Thomas Jefferson, and Andrew Jackson actually signed whatever document it was that was needed to make this valid, and the next president, forgot his name now, Lou had mentioned him in one of his shows, was the one that the actual so-called Trail of Tears occurred under. So it was really not actually Jackson. Everybody wants to blame Jackson for it as if it happened under his watch. He did sign the document, yes, but he was not actually responsible. And actually, when he left office, it wasn't that much longer after he left that he died. And so he was in poor health when he was actually in office. Now, I don't know if he was still alive when it happened, but there'd be nothing he could have done about it anyway. Probably would not have done anything about it anyhow. So, let me light this cigarette. Okay, where was I at here? It was the job of the Texas Rangers to drive these enemies of the white race out of Texas and make sure they stayed out. And yes, they did. They forced the Comanche and the Cherokee and any other Indians eventually all into the what is today the Oklahoma Territory. And again, I will discuss this in a lot more detail later. With such unstinting dedication and relentless energy did the Rangers do their job that both the Mexicans and the Indians soon learned their lesson the hard way. To come up against the Texas Rangers was to pay in blood, to leave their dead carcasses on the plains of Texas. Now this is the part I believe I read. The Texas Devils. So formidable a reputation did the Rangers earn for themselves that when General Winfield Scott's troops entered Mexico City in triumph in 1847, it was the Texas Rangers that the Mexicans feared the most. They referred to them as Los Diablos Tejanos, the Texas Devils. It was a reputation that stayed with them long after the Mexican War, and a name both the Mexicans and the Indians learned to hate and to fear throughout the winning of the West. Federal government aggravated the Indian problem. There is one other footnote in the history of Texas that is highly noteworthy to our struggle against the mud races. When Texas joined the Union during the last days of 1845, the federal government in Washington preempted the Indian problem, whereas the Texans and the Rangers had taken a hard stand of expulsion towards the Indian predators. The federal government reversed this policy and set up Indian reservations on Texas soil. I don't think that's true. I'll have to look into that. Made a number of meaningless treaties with them and actually protected, fed them, and in various ways subsidized these unwanted savages. Confusion and frustration ensued. The Indian problem was not solved, but on the contrary, aggravated to the chagrin of the Texans. There's only one Indian reservation in Texas, and it's so small, it's just a dot on the map. all the Indians were pushed into Oklahoma. I don't think there were ever actually any reservations on Texas. And I think the one that we have now was a modern one. It doesn't date back to the time of the ones I created in Oklahoma. I'll verify that. Okay, the next section, final solution by Texans. The white people of Texas began to wonder just whose side the federal government was on. Yeah, let me interject something. Our biggest mistake was joining the United States. Soon after we joined, we found ourselves embroiled in the slavery issue. You know, we really should have stayed on our own. And there was a faction, a division between the Texans at the time. Many wanted to remain independent and not join the United States, and wanted to expand to the Pacific Ocean and the Oregon Territory. Now, that may have been somewhat unrealistic without further influx of people into the country, but it was not out of the question. Nevertheless, it's clear that joining the United States was our biggest mistake. The second biggest mistake was when the Confederacy left the Union, we should not have joined the Confederacy. We should have just gone back to being a republic and saying to hell with all of this shit. And I'll cover more of that those topics later. It says, for 14 years, they tolerated this stupid nonsense. Finally, in 1859, they took matters into their own hands, abolished every reservation, and drove the Indians out of their territory, a task ably performed by the Rangers. After that, any Indian found in Texas was there at his own risk. Again, I'll look into that. But it is true. They drove every Indian out of Texas, except for just a few here and there. Cigarette went out. Hold on. Okay, let's see here. Credit and discredit. It is to the eternal credit of the Rangers and the early Texas settlers that the Indian problem was liquidated once and for all, and no reservations or wet nursing compounds for inferior Redskins remained in Texas. Not to the credit of their offspring is the toleration and proliferation of the vast and growing Mexican element, which is now smothering the white race in Texas and the southwestern states. And, in fact, the Mexican disease is spreading to the rest of America. Now, this article is old, but federal government controls immigration. There ain't a hell of a lot we can do. There was a time where they used to round up illegals here just like every place else. And I'm sure we did it longer than other places in the country did. And I'll get into the Operation Wetback that was done under Eisenhower. Yeah, actually, I think there may have been two Operation Wetbacks. I don't know. I will say this. There were several times in the 20th century when the United States literally had to round up illegal aliens from Mexico in the United States, not just Texas, and send them back to Mexico, and they always just came back. And I'll get to the topic of the border at another point. There's a lot that can be said about that. I mean, you know, there's always been Mexican raids into the United States territory. And most of you are familiar with Pancho Villa. And General Pershing was sent down into Mexico to try to find him, and he never actually found him. But today he would be called a terrorist, but he is a hero to the Mexicans. Eternal heroes. Among those of the Texas Rangers, we, the creators, especially point with pride as having contributed greatly to the building of the frontier of the white race, as much famous names as Lieutenant Jim Rice, Colonel Henry H. Harnes, and especially those great heroes of the Mexican War, Captains Ben McCullough and Sam Walker, who led many of the major attacks from Matamoros to Mexico City. And by the way, I just want to mention here that name, Lieutenant Jim Rice. I've done some research on that name here recently, and there are some Jews with that name, and there are some that are not. It's kind of like the name Miller. You can't tell just by the name whether or not they are Jewish or white, and I may discuss that topic again one day. in particular why I'm mentioning it now. Probably the greatest of them all is Colonel Jack C. Hayes of the Rangers San Antonio Company. Their exploits and those of the countless other Rangers, which we unfortunately cannot list, read like the heroic fiction of the annals of the white man's war against the treacherous Indians and their mongrelized half-brothers, the perfidious Mexicans. Our goals, those of the Texas Rangers. In today's continuing war against the Mexicans, it is our intention to revive the spirit and the goals of the 19th century Texas Rangers. Their goal was, as is today, to drive every Mexican and every Indian from the territory of the white man. What neither the Mexicans nor the Indians could win in the 19th century by force of arms, our treacherous Jewish government has aided them to achieve in the 20th century through sheer treachery by means of immigration, or what I call invasion, by means of welfare, by means of subsidizing, by allowing illegal Mexican aliens to invade our borders by the millions. We now have an intolerable situation where the mongrelized Mexican Indians are taking over not only the southwestern states that the white man won in the war of 1846 through 48, but are disseminating all over the United States into cities like Chicago and many others by invasion and sheer breeding. The Hispanics, so-called Hispanics, are even more prolific than the blacks. They are crowding out the white man in his own territory, surreptitiously swindling the white man out of coming to grips by means of any war of confrontation. And by the way, the phrase Hispanic, the word Hispanic means Spanish. Well, these mestizos are hardly Spanish. They may speak Spanish. They may have, and by the way, they don't speak proper Spanish. They speak slang Spanish. And they have very little Spanish blood in them, some more than others. Refer back to the show by Dr. Pierce. And I will be reading another article, by the way, from Dr. Pierce about this topic, probably this show. Okay, growing Hispanic menace. To show how serious the Mexican problem is, let us look at some figures as of the year 1980. The population of Mexico itself is now 70 million miserable, clawing creatures. By the end of the 20th century, Mexico City itself is projected to have a population of 32 million, probably outdistancing even Tokyo as the world's most populous city. The Hispanic groups in the United States are now stridently organizing for political muscle, and I might add by Jewish money and Rockefeller money. Of course, the Rockefellers are probably Jews. I would think they are. They include in their ranks Mexicans, Cubans, Puerto Ricans, and Filipinos, and claim to number 20 million. Not included in this group are another 10 million illegal aliens. You can add to that now, who are invading our borders with impunity by the thousands every day. If we add up the 70 million in Mexico itself, the 20 million and the 10 million illegals, this adds up to a formidable 100 million hostile, rapidly breeding mongrels who hate the white man with a passion and who are waiting for the day when they can wreak vengeance on the hated gringo whom they both envy and despise. And you can certainly add to those numbers. So the projection into the future. Now, as do rats and flies, these Hispanics, when fed and subsidized by the white man, can double their numbers rapidly. The Mexicans now, in fact, doubling their numbers every 20 years. This means the way we are now going, that in 20 years there will be 200 million of these mongrels on our back. In 40 years, there will be 400 million, and in 60 years, 800 million fierce, clawing, vengeance-seeking hostiles in our midst. 60 years is not that far away, but long before that time, unless we alter course, the white race in America and the world will long have been wiped out by the rapidly hostile mixed races of the world. Let me relight this cigarette. The war continues. We of the creativity movement therefore want to urge and inspire every red-blooded white man to action, to take up again the war on the hostile mongrels where our heroic forefathers of the Mexican War left off. We again call the white man to arms to revive again the spirit of the Texas Rangers, whose motto was, "The only good Indian was a dead Indian," and vowed to drive the mongrelized Mexicans and Indians forever from the soil and territory of Texas. Like the Texans of the Alamo, we of the creativity movement declare war on the mongrels. Like the Rangers, Texas Rangers, our goals must be to cleanse our lands of the savages and the mongrels. The early Texans realized that in their vast territory there was an irreconcilable conflict of three races, the Mexican, the Indian, and the white race. They could never live together in peace, and the white man could only survive by either driving out or destroying the other two. As Texas Governor M. Bonaparte Lamar, actually I think that would be President, 1838 through 1840, succinctly stated, "The white man and the red man cannot live in harmony together. Nature forbids it," and I will be discussing him more in detail later. He, if I remember correctly, led the faction who did not want to join the United States. He realized the United States policy of moderation and forbearance towards the Indians had been a total failure, and the proper policy was one of total expulsion. Our eternal legacy. With this policy, we agree not only towards the Indians, but also toward their racial kinsmen, the Mexicans, and all other races who would oppose us. It is not our policy to make the world safe for democracy, the Jewish idea and swindle at best, but on the contrary, to make the world safe for the white race, not only in our time, but for our children and their future progeny, eternally and forever. The war with Mexico is unfinished, is what the next section is called. Exploding birth rate. I'm going to interject something here. You know, even with government assistance, these people are able to have huge families. It just does not cost anything to raise any of them. You know, they're not used to having material things like white people are. You know, if you try to raise, you know, a white family properly, then you provide things for your children, short of spoiling them. Of course, some people do spoil their children, but that way they become responsible adults. Well, most of these invaders, they don't have to provide all of these things for their children, and therefore, as a result, they're able to outbreed us significantly. I think most of us are well aware of that. The war with Mexico, again, the war with Mexico is unfinished. The birth rate of Mexicans today and their purported Latino neighbors to the south, I wouldn't call them Latin in any way, however that's what they're called, is the highest in the world, even exceeding that of the well-fed and subsidized blacks in the United States. They, the blacks, and other races of the world are a bigger threat to us than the hydrogen bomb. If we don't soon face the wild and unchecked invasion of these races into white man's territory, we will soon be swamped into a cesspool of chaos, unchecked invasions becoming a stampede. It is hard to tell at this point in history whether the blacks or the Mexicans or the Cubans or the Haitians are the biggest threat to the white race in America, but let's not waste time haggling about that question. The point is they all are, as the tremendous influx of Chinese, Jamaicans, Vietnamese, and millions of other mud races who are starving in their own countries and want to get on the backs of the white man's generous subsidy. They bring with them nothing but bad news, disease, poverty, and mongrelization, along with the draining of our resources. Let me clear my throat here real quick. 800 million Mexicans in 60 years. That's the name of the next section. Of them, all the Mexican invasion, says, of them, all the Mexican invasion is the most rapidly accelerating threat. This is partly due to our 2,000-mile-long common border. The population of Mexico today in 1980, I guess that's when this was written, is 70 million. And as I have already pointed out, it is doubling every 20 years. Well, let's see, geez. 1980 was, what, 30 years ago? Let's see, 90, 2000, yeah, well over 30 years ago. In 60 years, as I have also pointed out, if the Hispanic element, so-called Hispanic element, is left unchecked, the North American continent will be infested with 800 million Mexican-Hispanic mongrels. 60 years is not a long time. Need we go further? For centuries, Mexico has been able to feed their people. As a result, they swarm, as hasn't been able to feed their people. As a result, they swarm across the border into the United States by the millions each year to get on welfare, to feed and to breed. In the last decade or so, they have made alarming inroads in the population of California, Arizona, New Mexico, and other southwestern states. With the one-sided help of the Jewish anti-white federal government, they have also gained tremendous political power. The Mexicans make no bones about their racial hatred and their social and political goals. On the school boards, on the municipal level, they openly brag they will outbreed and drive the gringo out of these territories that once, he says, belonged to Mexico. Actually, it was a claim. However, they did receive the claim from Spain in a treaty between the United States and Spain. I'll get into that. At this point, neither the white man nor the United States government is lifting a finger to stop this outrage. On the contrary, collaboration and betrayal are the order of the day. And so, as you see, nothing has changed in 30 years. It's not going to. At some point, something is going to either get out of hand or people are going to have to just start taking under control their own destiny somehow. I say somehow. Use your imagination. Okay, thinking gone berserk. Let us remember, therefore, that the Mexicans are succeeding only because the white man is letting them, and the white man is stupidly letting them because his racial creed is all fouled up by Jewish Christian propaganda coupled with Jewish betrayal. It is up to the creativity movement to correct this horrible tragedy and clear the white man's brain. Well, they didn't last real long. I think when Matt Helt went to jail, that was pretty much the end of it. At the heading of this chapter, we called the Mexican War an unfinished war. We couldn't be more serious. We have a war of major proportions on our hands, a war in which the present government, as usual, is betraying the white race and is on the side of our enemies. Whether we know it or not, it is a war we are losing at present, but can easily reverse if we get our bearings straight. So let us clear away the mental cobwebs that shackle our thinking and adopt an aggressive, meaningful program. We have no time to lose. And again, that was written 30 years ago. It says what we must do. If this starts drifting away from the issue of taxes, I'll pretty much cease to finish it. But I think it's still discussing that issue. I just don't want to get off topic. However, this is it's still related, no matter how you slice it. Okay, what we must do, number one. The first thing we must do is seal our borders from any further invasion of the Mexican hordes. After that, they are violating our immigration laws and therefore are criminal invaders. Since they are swarming in by the millions, what is the difference if they are doing so as a military army or as civilian invaders? The results are the same. They are taking over our land and living space. Therefore, I propose we get tough and enforce the laws we now have. And by the way, like I said, you don't control it unless you occupy it and control it. They're occupying it. They don't control it yet, but they're getting close. Okay. Therefore, I propose we get tough and enforce the laws we now have, as well as, I think, get some new ones. Set up machine guns and mow them down mercilessly as they try to invade us. Well, if necessary, I think we need to build a wall, to be honest. says this will definitely put a stop to this outrage. Yes, it would. Number two, change the immigration law so that the immigration quota from Mexico is an absolute zero. In fact, it ought to be zero from everywhere, unless it is a white person from anywhere. I think we should transplant all the whites in South Africa here and just let all of our blacks here go there. And that has been said by several other people on this network. Number three, the next step is to aggressively comb the Mexican population for illegal aliens in our midst. Their very presence, too, is an outrage against our sovereign territory, and all we need to do is strictly enforce the law as it now stands. Every illegal alien must be booted back into Mexico and told in no uncertain terms that if they ever again cross the border or are found on U.S. soil, they will be shot on sight. Okay, so they're undocumented now? Well, when we send them back, let's document them so we will know if they were here to begin with and come back. Number four. Once we have accomplished that much, the next step is to forcibly ship back to Mexico all Mexicans of that racial origin, whether they are citizens or not, whether they were born here or not. Sevier, remember what Santa Anna did to the Texans when they had the power. And by the way, I'm going to interject something. Santa Anna said that one day Mexico will get Texas back. Do you want that to happen? Okay, I'll move on. Number five. The next step is to adopt the same program as our great President Polk and courageous forefathers did in 1836 and again in 1845 through 48, and that is push the white man's boundaries farther southward. Okay, we now have a racial policy. Let me just kind of glance at this real quick. I'm going to skip part of that. And I'm going to jump to the next section because I think this is more related. And I believe this is the final section of this article. The winning of the West, our blueprint for winning of the world. Our blueprint. You know, I really don't like to use that term, blueprint. All a blueprint is just a reproduction of a plan. I like saying a plan, okay? And that's because of my business that I'm in. Anyway, and actually they're not blueprints anymore. They're blue lines on white paper. And actually they don't even do that. They plot, or they used to plot with ink, and now they plot by printing. Things have changed. Since the winning of the West was the finest and greatest achievement in the history of the white race, we want to weave this theme into our religious program. Now, let me say something here about what I just read. You know, my last show and some of my other shows involved topics that were uniquely American, and I think they've been ignored by people in Europe who do listen to the Renegade Broadcasting as if somehow they don't apply to them. But I think that last sentence that I just read, and I'll read it again, will serve as inspiration. And I think that, like we do here in the United States, we cover issues from all over the world, and in particular the white countries or the formerly all-white countries, that people in Europe should be covering the issues here and not ignoring them. Okay, we realize that you look down on us in Europe, but we have to stop doing that sort of thing. This is too important of an issue. Survival is more important than what you think of us, okay? Now I'm going to reread that. Since the winning of the West was the finest and greatest achievement in the history of the white race, we want to weave this theme into our religious program. We want to remind and reemphasize to our white racial comrades of the spirit of work, hardship, and fighting and colonization of the 19th century that produced the greatness of America. We want to remind our people that conquest and colonialization is the American way, and to have some insipid, bleeding hearts roadblock every action the white race takes for its own survival would not only be condemned as being un-American, but will also be considered as treason against the white race itself. We again want to remind any traitors of how General Scott handled the traitors at Churubusco. The Western heritage, our trademark. Therefore, instead of adopting, now that's a miss, that's a typo. I think it says, it meant to be adopting. It says, therefore, instead of adopting, say, the Nazi style of military dress and formal, parentheses, which we also admire, we prefer the Western style of dress in the manner of the cowboy or the U.S. cavalry or the Texas Rangers. Well, I don't think we should go around dressing quite like that, but there's something, there's certainly nothing wrong with that if you live in the right environment, okay? Okay, that's what it says here, so I read it. We also will stress cowboy and country music, folk music, square dancing, and other customs that reflect our heritage. We will also encourage a revival of the architecture of the Western frontier towns for our religious buildings. Why not? That is our real heritage, and we want to emphasize that the foundations of the creativity movement are not only grounded in the history and heritage of the white race itself, but these foundations are also rooted in early America. They are not a foreign import, but thoroughly American in every way. Our proud slogan must be, "The winning of the West is the blueprint for the winning of the world." Or shall I say, "The winning of the West is the plan for the winning of the world." Now, let me go back to the studio here. And I'm going to take a short break. And I'm going to play another artist from Texas. And by the way, you heard Stevie Ray Vaughan earlier. And I'll say this about Stevie Ray Vaughan. Most of you know he was killed in a helicopter crash when he was on tour with Eric Clapton sometime in the, I think, the late 1980s. Or very, it was early 90s maybe. I don't remember now. But if any of you have seen a photograph of him, you know, a straight shot, you know, head on, you'll notice his nose is a little bit on the wide side. He is not part black. He broke his nose and he never bothered to have any cosmetic surgery. So anyway, he is from Dallas, Texas. And the other music I've been playing so far in this series has been all ZZ Top, who is a Houston-based band. One member is from Dallas, one is from Houston, one is from Northeast Texas. Billy Gibbons, the lead guitarist, is from Houston. He went to Robert E. Lee High School here in Houston. My girlfriend went to that high school. I used to have a friend, I don't know where he is now, who's about 10 years older than me, the same age as Billy Gibbons. Used to know the man when he went to school with him. And the politically correct people have changed the name of the school from Robert E. Lee to just Lee. And they were called the Lee Rebels, Robert E. Lee Rebels. I think they're still called the Rebels, but if you leave off the Robert E. Lee, what does it matter anymore, right? So, anyway, Stevie Ray Vaughan, by the way, is from Dallas. Edgar and Johnny Winter are from Beaumont. And Janis Joplin is from Port Neches, or Port Arthur, I don't remember which. I think it's Port Neches. And those are just some Texas artists, and I'll be playing all Texas music throughout this series. And I will even at some point, as the series goes along, get into the country music as well. And there are probably more country artists than there are rock and roll artists who are from Texas. So, without further ado, here is some Edgar Winter. Okay, I guess you noticed that was not the album version of that song that was done for a music video. So anyway, I just thought I would play something a little different than what you're normally used to hearing. What I've got next here is an article by Dr. William Pierce. It was posted on the National Vanguard website on November 11, 2004, and it was transcribed. The name of the article is called The Men of the Alamo. I don't know if this was ever an audio lecture, or rather audio show, whatever you want to call it, that he gave on the topic, but nevertheless, I did not look for it on YouTube or anywhere else to try and find an audio of it. I've got it written, and so I just thought I would go ahead and read it. So anyway, it's from, I do know that what this, it says here, it was from a publication called Attack, number 55, from 1977. And by the way, Dr. William Pierce went to Rice University here in Houston. That wasn't for postgraduate, but that was for college. And Rice University is considered to be the Harvard of the South. It's a very small private elite school. In fact, they're called the Rice Owls. Owls, as in wise. Okay, I forgot what the term is for the school's whatchamacallit. Anyway, here and there for the purpose of this. Let me begin. So dead shall live on in the memory of their race, and we, remembering, shall have their example always before us. As the dusk gathered in the early evening on March 5th, 1836, William Travis mustered the 183, it says here, men under his command on the dusky plaza of the Alamo, a fortress-like former Spanish mission. As the assembled Texans listened intently, the lucky officer outlined the situation. He made it explicit what everyone already knew. There was little hope of surviving the onslaught of the Mexican army. It says 4,000 strong, but there were 6,000, I think, total in the whole army in Texas. But he didn't use the whole, total for his army for the assault. Anyway, 4,000 strong Mexican army which surrounded the fortress. They could hope for no further relief. Then he did something strange. As the men watched curiously, Travis drew his sword and traced a line in the dust along the front of the first rank. Now he offered the men a choice. If there was anyone among them who had been deceived as to the gravity of their circumstances, if there was anyone who wanted to make a break for it, they might leave without infringing their honor. But let those who stand and die with Travis cross the line. Let me clear my throat. Okay, Macaja Autry, an itinerant scholar and poet from Tennessee, was the first across the line. David Crockett, the legendary rifleman, quickly followed, and then James Bonham, the dashing horseman from South Carolina. As his wife Susanna watched from the shadows of the old mission's wall, Almiron Dickinson, a blacksmith from Gonzales, turned artilleryman across the line. The rest followed in a rush, whooping defiance of Mexican General Santa Anna and his horde. Only two men remained behind the line, one of them Jim Bowie, the storied knife fighter, lay on a cot, desperately ill. He begged to be carried across, and two of his comrades quickly hefted him over the line. Now only Moses Lewis Rose, a Jewish mercenary from France, hung back. Bowie had earlier befriended Rose, called out weakly, "You seem not to be willing to die with us, Rose." Rose answered curtly, "No, I am not prepared to die, and I shall not do so if I can avoid it." With that, he vaulted over the wall, stealthily made his way past the Mexican pickets, and vanished into the night. Some years later, he died eventually, of course, Now I'm going to interject something here. We don't really 100% know that this actually happened. It is a legend. However, if one man left or others left, there's rumors that others may have left. That is the only way we would know of this, is if somebody had actually left. Now, it's quite possible that this is a true story. And, of course, this would actually be coming from a Jew. But then at the same time, he's praising the Texans in this. So, no matter what, one can draw some inspiration from this. The next day, the men of the Alamo won immortality. Travis's drawing of the line was only the most dramatic episode in the Alamo saga. At one time, the details of the siege and fall of the Texas stronghold were well known to every white American. Even today, the facade of the Alamo Chapel, all that remains of the old mission, is a familiar picture. Movies and television shows drafting from an era in which the masters of Hollywood found a feigned patriotism expedient as well as profitable have acquainted many with the externals of the story. And actually, let me interject something here. John Wayne, who was stringently anti-communist, to my knowledge, was the first one to do it in modern times. There were some earlier films that were really just kind of pathetic. And even if today's standards, you know, if you go see the Alamo from 2004 compared to John Wayne's Alamo, even John Wayne's Alamo is really kind of, you know, just goofy. But nevertheless, in 1960, it was a movie worth seeing. And most Americans saw that movie. The set for that movie, I think, is actually still intact. Somewhere in Texas, I forgot the name of the town. They left it intact completely as it was when they shot the movie. The most significant aspects of the Texans' gallant last stand, however, have been for a long time carefully veiled. They deserve to become, once again, the common possession of our people. And the bravery of the men of the Alamo deserves commemoration as long as our race endures. The Texas Revolution, of which the Battle of the Alamo was the most stirring event, was the inevitable result of the confrontation of two vastly different peoples, the immigrants from the United States, whom Mexico had reluctantly allowed to settle Texas. Not really. It wasn't reluctant at first. It became reluctant later. Which was then a part of Mexico, were overwhelmingly of Northern European stock. The Texas historian T.R. Fehrenbach, by the way, I have one of his books, has described them as a tall, very Caucasoid race, more raw-boned than wiry. They filled the ridges and valleys with fair-skinned people and blue-eyed children. Most of them had come from the southern and border states. There, the settlers' race feeling, already strong, had been honed to a sharp edge in the murderous and incessant Indian wars and by their association with slaves, either as owners or as competitors in the labor market. These white men and women of Texas felt themselves to be the vanguard of their race, and they meant to wring their destiny, manifest or otherwise, from the plains and mountains which stretched from across the remainder of the continent. Now let me interject something here on slaves in Texas. Mexico outlawed slavery. So what the people did when they came here with their slaves was they told the slave that in order for them to be free, they had to come up with the value of their cost. And in so doing so, they had no money. Were not in a position to make any money. They basically were indentured servants for life. So they were able to hold on to their slaves in that manner. And really, there weren't that many Jewish slave owners here in Texas. There was one plantation by the name of Gross, and I'll cover that more at a later point. And that's the only main one that I know of. Most of the slaves in Texas were owned by white people, unlike the rest of the South, where they were mainly owned by Jews. If you'll recall a show that I did with Mike, and if you look in Mike's show archives, you'll find it. I think it was from January of 2013. you can hear the show on that and our discussion. Certainly very detailed. Anyway, the Mexicans, who were mostly of Indian or mixed mestizo blood, regarded these Anglo-Saxon barbarians with increasing fear and resentment. The government had only allowed Texas to be settled from the United States after it had become clear that the native Mexicans from the South could not be induced to move to the sparsely settled northern province. As American farmers and ranchers poured into Texas after 1822, they quickly came to outnumber the small Mexican population. By 1830, the Mexican government had forbidden any future immigration from the growing giant to the north, and I'll get into why they were invited into Texas. It was not just because Mexicans wouldn't move there. They couldn't deal with the Indians. The white man could. Okay, back to the article. When Santa Anna converted his presidency into a dictatorship and abolished the Constitution, which had provided for a federated rather than a centralized Mexican state, the Texans rose up, and I'll get into that more deeply as well. They quickly overwhelmed the smaller Mexican garrisons throughout the state, then seized the capital, San Antonio de Bejar, B-E-X-A-R, by storm, overpowering a large force commanded by Santa Anna's brother-in-law, General Cos, C-O-S, in December 1835. Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna was Mexico's leading general as well as her most adroit politician. He had emerged as a national hero after repelling a Spanish attempt to reconquer Mexico at Veracruz in 1829. Monumentally vain and extravagant, the self-styled Napoleon of the West, nevertheless a dynamic organizer as well as a charismatic leader, he quickly assembled and drilled an army of 6,000 Mexican regulars, trained and led in accordance with the latest continental European principles. With this elite force, he marched north from Saltillo, Mexico, at the end of January 1836, determined to crush the upstart American rebels and then settle the problem once and for all by a program of summary executions and mass deportations. And I will interject, and as I've said before, he had intentions on planting the Mexican flag in Washington, D.C. Now, we are getting near the end of the show. There's a little less than 5 minutes in the main broadcast, and it will go into the archives. I'll probably just wrap up this article, play some music in the show. Last time I tried to go into the archives, I got about a half an hour, and the show just ended on me. Don't know what happened. The quality of the recording was not good in spots. But anyway, if you're listening live and would like to call in so you can catch the rest of the show over the phone, please do so now. The call-in number is 215-383-5775. The reports which Santa Anna's numerous sympathizers among San Antonio's Mexican population brought him concerning the state of the city's white garrison must have heightened the contempt the Mexican general felt for the abilities of the American fighting men. The force which had seized San Antonio the previous December had dwindled to fewer than 100 men in January. Only a few dozen reinforcements augmented the detachment as the Mexicans made their way north. There was bad blood between the top-ranking Texans, with both Jim Bowie and William Barrett Travis attempting to exercise command. Now, let me say this. Nobody expected Santa Anna to arrive in Texas as early as he did. He arrived in mid-February. Most were not expecting him to come until at least mid-March, near the beginning of spring. And he had to march his men through mountainous areas of Mexico and certainly through some very cold temperatures and snow. Okay, back to the article. The Texans holding San Antonio had their strengths as well as their weaknesses, as Santa Anna and his men were to discover. The fighting spirit of those who remained was high. Most of them were volunteers from outside Texas whose elan, if anything, surpassed that of their Texas brethren. At the defense, the American frontiersmen were among the most effective soldiers in the world. They fired their long Kentucky rifles with deadly accuracy at ranges up to 200 yards. At close quarters, they were devastating with knife and tomahawk. A tendency toward indiscipline was counterbalanced by self-reliance and self-sufficiency not to be found among the Mexicans. Nevertheless, Santa Anna nearly caught the Texans napping as he advanced to San Antonio on February 23rd. Travis, the nominal commander by virtue of his status as the senior regular officer, hadn't thought the Mexicans capable of crossing several hundred miles of arid plains between Saltillo and San Antonio so rapidly. Santa Anna, however, had driven his troops mercilessly, and his advance guard swept into the city, the Texans barely had time to retire to the shelter of the Alamo. Let me clear my throat. The Alamo had been built as a mission to the Indians by the Franciscan Order in 1718, but it had been abandoned in 1793. Although it derived its name from a company of soldiers from the Mexican town of Alamo de Parras, who had subsequently been stationed there, it was not well suited for defense, especially by so small a force the Texas command, as Travis commanded. The compound consisted of a large rectangular plaza adjoined on the east by a smaller plaza in the old mission chapel. The larger plaza was enclosed by a thick wall 12 feet high. Inside and adjacent to the wall were the former mission workshops and living quarters, which served the garrison as barracks, storerooms, and offices. The chapel at the southeast corner of the mission was filled with rubble. Its roof had fallen in years before. And just FYI, when the Spanish came to North America, and I presume South America, they did the same. They created what was called missions, and they were Catholic, and they were there to convert the Indians to Catholicism. It was not very effective, but anyway, they built a lot of these what are called missions all over the Southwest and in Mexico and what is referred to as Central or Latin America, and they may have done it in South America as well. And that's what the Alamo was. Just FYI, the Alamo was certainly, it's an old building. It's all that's left of the compound there now in San Antonio, and it is in downtown. At the time, downtown, or rather the town of San Antonio, not downtown, but the town of San Antonio was outside of the mission area. It was adjacent to it. So when Santa Anna showed up, all the people except for the native Mexicans, who the natives had nothing to fear from Santa Anna, by the way, headed to the Alamo, and Santa Anna quickly surrounded the whole town and the mission and occupied the town. The Alamo's front wall fell down sometime in the 1800s, part of it, not all of it. And the United States Corps of Engineers reconstructed it to what they thought it might look like. Part of it had already crumbled before this battle took place. It was old when this happened. And this was well over 180 years ago. So anyway, Green Jameson, a lawyer from Kentucky, who was the Texans' chief engineer, had worked hard to strengthen the Alamo's spots. A breach in the north wall had been plugged by stones and timber. On the southeast, where there was a dangerous gap between the wall and the chapel, a palisade of logs surrounded a totally constructed earthwork. Hastily constructed earthwork. Now the Texans intensified their efforts. As well, a well was dug to supplement the water from a stream flowing close outside the walls. Gun emplacements were readied in the ruins of the chapel. David Crockett and his handful of fellow Tennesseans, who had arrived in San Antonio only 2 weeks before, were assigned the critical palisade on the southeast. And I'll discuss David Crockett more in detail at a later point. As the men hauled the Alamo's 14 guns into positions on the walls, they caught sight of Santa Anna's flag fluttering from the bell tower of the San Fernando Cathedral on the outskirts of the city, a few hundred yards away. It was blood red, and it signified no quarter. A short while later, the lookout spotted another flag. This one was white. Evidently, Santa Anna wanted to talk. Travis, who knew of Santa Anna's proclaimed intent to exterminate every white man within its limits, referring to Texas, ordered his gunners to reply with a blast of cannon fire. That night, Jim Bowie collapsed. Bowie, whose reputation as an intrepid Indian fighter and the master of the knife which bore his name, was known across the frontier, had been regarded by the volunteers from outside Texas as the garrison's rightful commander. He had not discouraged this opinion, for he had been a leader all his life, and he regarded the younger Travis as inexperienced. And remember, I said Travis was only 27 years old. The friction between the two and Bowie's greater popularity among the men had almost led Travis to resign. Now, with Bowie desperately ill, command rested solely in Travis's hands. He was 27, I believe. He had already established himself as a champion of white Texans' rights, and I'll go into that at a later point. Many of his more complacent fellow Texans has regarded him as an irresponsible firebrand until events upheld his audacity. And by the way, he had red hair. In 1832, he had been imprisoned in the coastal town of Anahuac, which is just east of present-day Houston, for challenging the authority of Colonel John Bradburn, an autocratic American in the Mexican service who was widely regarded as a race traitor by white Texans. Then in 1835, Travis returned to Anahuac with a group of comrades and seized the town, helping to spark the current secession. At the Alamo, he would capitalize on his opportunity for greatness. Clear my throat. During the night of February 23rd, the Mexicans closed the ring around the Alamo, carefully staying out of range of the defenders' rifles after the Texas marksmen had claimed several of the less cautious. On the next day, in a dispatch, which still stands as a classic expression of American heroism, Travis appealed to the people of Texas and all Americans in the world for aid. Recognizing the possibility of insufficient reinforcement, he ended this message, which was smuggled through the Mexican lines that night by a volunteer. This is what it says. "I shall never surrender or retreat. Then I call on you in the name of liberty, of patriotism, and everything dear to the American character, to come to our aid with all dispatch. If this call is neglected, I am determined to sustain myself as long as possible and die like a soldier who never forgets what is due to his honor and that of his country, victory or death." And that is famously known as Travis's letter. There were other dispatches, but that one is clearly the most well-known. The first week of the siege was comparatively uneventful. The Mexicans lobbed cannonballs into the Alamo periodically without inflicting any casualties. The Texans, low on powder and shot, husbanded their ammunition. There was no reply to Travis's appeal for help. And by the way, I will go into significantly more detail on all of these events. I'm just trying to get these major articles out of the way, written by people in our movement who are well known and who have contributed greatly to it, and who has offered us inspiration as well, because they had plenty to say about Texas. Then in the early morning darkness of March 1st, 32 horsemen burst through the Mexican lines and galloped through the hastily opened gates of the Alamo. The Mexican sentries caught off guard, didn't fire a shot. The riders were Texans from Gonzales, 70 miles east of San Antonio, led by George Kimball, a hatter. Now, if you don't know what a hatter is, it's somebody who makes hats. You've heard of the phrase Mad Hatter. Well, they used, I forgot what it was called. There's a substance they use to make hats, and ultimately it would affect your brain. And thus the term Mad Hatter. Because people who made hats, I guess, usually went nuts after a while from being exposed to it. All of them had families and were fully aware of the overwhelming odds facing the Alamo, but they rallied all the more enthusiastically to the relief of their countrymen. They were the only reinforcements, save one, the Alamo would receive. Now, actually, these men, let me interject something, these men who arrived were expecting Colonel Fannin, who was stationed at the Goliad mission, to arrive. And, of course, he had orders from Houston to retreat. And I'll get into that in more detail later. But these men went there on the assumption that 400 men were also going to show up. One more American braved the Mexican lines to reach the Alamo. He was James Butler Bonham, a chivalrous young lawyer from a wealthy family in South Carolina and a distant cousin of Travis. Bonham had dispatched by Travis, had been dispatched by Travis on February 27th to persuade the sizable force at Goliad to march to the aid of the Alamo. The commander at Goliad was Colonel James Fannin, an indecisive and unstable officer. And I'll get into more details about him at a later point, although he did go to West Point. When it became clear to Bonham that Fannin intended to stay in Goliad, he prepared to return to the Alamo. When Fannin implored him not to throw his life away, Bonham spat in the dust and snarled that Travis deserved to know the answer to his appeals. After stopping at Gonzales and learning of the departure of the local men, he rode westward to Glory, passing through the Mexican lines unscathed on March 3rd. Santa Anna, by the way, did not care how many people showed up, so they all were able to just go right through the Mexican lines. In fact, Santa Anna was hoping that Sam Houston would show up. His intent, obviously, was to make himself a track record, and the more famous people known that he would put to death, the more acclaim he would have. And he became aware of the presence of David Crockett after his arrival there. And again, David Crockett was from Tennessee, and he was a congressman, former U.S. congressman. Says the drama was drawing to its conclusion. As Travis drew the line, March 5th, Santa Anna, buoyed by reinforcements from the south, was planning his assault on the Texan's fortress. Shortly before daybreak the next morning, March 6th, 1836, the Texans awakened to the alarms of their sentries and the rhythmic tramp of thousands of marching feet. I'm having a little problem reading this on my older computer. Four columns were headed for the Alamo. Actually, I'll get into that in more detail. It's a little bit more complicated than columns. Two groups marching toward the north wall of the plaza, a third striking from the east, the fourth detachment moving from the south against David Crockett's palisade. They're not columns, but I'll go over that in another point. But there were four main positions. And they did have to wind up shifting one because of the resistance by the Texans. And the Texans were totally surprised, by the way, because they were all asleep. Santa Anna had constantly played marching music and periodically would throw cannonballs at them, kept them to where they could hardly sleep for about 2 weeks. And right before the assault, he let them sleep to catch them off guard. Over the cheers of the attacking Mexicans, the Texans could hear the regimental band blaring out the menacing strains of the Deguayo, a march from Spain's Moorish Pass, the name derived from a word for throat cutting or cut throat. Now, actually, I doubt very seriously he had bands playing when the attack occurred. What actually happened was that they had the men march very quietly up to where their positions were to be, and they were to lay on their stomachs until given order to attack. And actually, one Mexican got overly excited and kind of screwed it up and yelled out, "Viva Santa Anna, Viva Mexico," or something along those lines. And at that point, everybody just kind of went ahead and just started attacking. The Texans heard it, woke up. And had that not happened, it probably would have been a worse slaughter. Even in the dim light of the pre-dawn, the Texans could make out the gaudy braid and silver the Mexican officers sported on their uniforms. Once again, the Kentucky rifle proved its mettle as the defenders poured a devastating fire into the ranks of the advancing Mexicans. Officers and men fell by the scores, then the hundreds. Twice the Mexicans reeled back until reinforced by Santa Anna's reserve, and at a terrible cost, the two northern columns reached the base of the Alamo Wall. And yes, Santa Anna poured in reserves because at one point he panicked and actually thought, because of the resistance of the Texans, that he was actually losing the battle. Anyway, now deprived of the advantage the much greater range of the rifles had given them and hampered their cavalry, not without heavy losses, and poured over the wall. Over the walls. That's a typo. Plural, walls. Travis fell at the north wall, shot through the head, and actually he died pretty quickly. As the Mexicans surged into the plaza, the Texans engaged them hand to hand. Towering over the diminutive mestizos, they wielded tomahawks, knives, and fists to murderous effect. A gun crew on the west wall swung their piece around and riddled the Mexicans in the plaza with grape shot before they too were overwhelmed. And actually, they used their guns as clubs. As more and more Mexicans swarmed over the wall, the outnumbered Texans fell back into the barracks and storerooms. Only at numerous casualties were the Mexicans able to kill or dislodge the defenders. When the Mexicans burst into one small room, they found the defiant Jim Bowie, too weak to rise from his cot, but brandishing revolver, says a revolver, but I'm sure he had at least two. He shot several of the assailants before he succumbed, probably by bayonet. Behind the palisade in the chapel, Crockett's and Bonham's men still held out. The Mexicans overran them after a brief but bitter struggle. Crockett and his Tennessee volunteers lay surrounded by heaps of dead Mexicans. Major Robert Evans was shot down, torch in hand, as he crawled to blow up the Alamo's powder magazine. Now, I don't know if that part is true, but that was in the John Wayne movie. I'll look into that. Bonham and Dickinson fell by their guns in the chapel. For 15 minutes after the last Texan had been killed, the Mexican troops, stunned by the ferocity of resistance, continued to bayonet and shoot the dead defenders. Santa Anna hastened to restore order. He allowed Almiron Dickinson's wife and infant daughter, the only white woman of the Alamo, to ride west to Gonzales, presumably to spread terror with their story. The Mexican tyrant also ceremoniously liberated Travis's black slave, Joe, who had been found cowering in his storeroom. Now, let me explain something here. Santa Anna gave the women and children and Negroes an opportunity to leave. And they all had a chance to leave a day or two before the actual attack. However, Dickinson's wife chose to stay. And after the battle, Santa Anna sent her towards the Texas settlements to spread the word of what had happened. And that's one of the reasons we also have some sort of a story to go by here, aside from the Mexicans and this black slave named Joe. And there was also Bowie's slave actually was told to leave by Bowie. Okay. The more than 1,500 Mexican casualties were attended to. I don't think there was 1,500. It was probably more like about 600. I mean, it's just 1,500 is outrageous. There's a lot of myth that has been passed down over the years. You know, by the same token, there may have been more than 180-something men. There may have been as many as 250. We just don't have all their names. And there were also a handful of Mexicans who were opposed to Santa Anna, a very small few. And actually, there was a situation of brother against brother. There was one Mexican whose brother was in the Mexican army that was actually attacking the Alamo. Let me clear my throat. Okay. The dead were buried under the supervision of San Antonio's Mexican mayor, Francisco Ruiz, while the wounded were ministered to by the city's Mexican population. But the Texas dead Santa Ana sought to dishonor by denying them burial. He ordered the bodies of every one of the Alamo's 180-something defenders burned. And that's true. He poured oil all over them and burned them. No one really knows for sure where their remains actually are. And so the great funeral pyre was enveloped in the flames, and the fire consumed the men of the Alamo, just as countless times, 1,000 years before, it had consumed the fallen heroes of whom their ancestors had sung in the long houses and the great halls of Northern Europe. Like all the champions of their race, the Texans treasured honor and courage above life itself. The echoes of their heroism reverberated at San Jacinto 6 weeks later, when Sam Houston's men avenged them on Santa Ana, and for a century afterward, their memory gave Americans the strength to face hopeless odds resolutely. Now, as the alien subverters stealthily worked their will behind the scenes, few white Americans hearkened to the lessons of the Alamo. Throughout the whole American Southwest, the mestizo descendants of Santa Ana's hordes bid to win back what he lost as the brown flood streams unchecked across the borders. It is time to renew the pact between the living and the dead, that they shall live on in the memory of their race, and that we, remembering, shall have their example always before us, exhorting us to carry out unflinchingly whatever the future of our race requires. End. Okay, let me go back to the studio here, and we'll play another song, and I'm going to do something before I actually close the show. Hold on, let me get back there, and I'm going to play some Janis Joplin.
coming. Nothing's going to harm me now.
Okay, what I think I'm going to do here, I'm not going to, certainly not going to do a lot of reading and talking because they could just, this show could just end without notice. And there's still a little ways here. Let's see, 1, 2, 3. We've still got a little bit of recording left, time left. I'm going to, I've got some recordings that I got from YouTube. These were marketing videos to help business in Texas, and in 2009. So some of the data is a little bit old, but what I'm going to do is there's four of them, and they're all, you know, 8 to 9 minutes long. And we'll see how much time I have after I play part of them. But it tells you about modern Texas, what it's like now. And I won't do it on this show, but I'll probably do it on the next. I'll correct anything that it needs to be corrected or additionally updated, especially population figures. And this is just an FYI. You know, this is just information. I'm not saying, hey, you need to come to Texas because of this. However, I will say this. The business climate here is always better than it is in most of the country. Unless some other part of the country just has a local boom. Texas is always the last to feel every economic downturn and the first to come back. One of the reasons I've stayed here, I mean, I could theoretically have moved, you know, many times, just because if I move somewhere else, what happens when the economy goes sour? I'll be right back here. So I may as well just stay here. Anyway, this first one is just about Texas. I have two more that was done for Houston and one that was done for Dallas-Fort Worth. I think there are some more in the series. I'm not sure. But I'll do the Dallas-Fort Worth and Houston on the next show. And, again, I'll commentate on the next show about errors and omissions and additions, corrections, et cetera, then. So, anyway, here is the first one. This is called Texaplex 1. And the second one is called Texaplex 2. Then I will play a song and end the show afterwards. So here's the first one. There may be a little bit of silence here. It's playing, I know that, but I'm not hearing anything.
In the face of national headlines delivering nothing but grim economic news, Texas is a lone star, shining bright, a beacon of stability, growth, and prosperity. Let's take a closer look and see why everyone is talking about Texas. If Texas were a country, it would be the 10th largest country in the world. It would have the 12th largest economy in the world based on gross domestic product, ahead of Mexico, Russia, and India. It would be the 5th largest oil and gas producing country in the world. Texas is big. It's the only state with its own power grid. King Ranch alone has 1 million acres and is bigger than the entire state of Rhode Island. Texas is 267,339 square miles. That's 7.4% of the nation. It's bigger than New England, New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Illinois combined. Even DFW Airport is bigger than Manhattan. Texas is home to the largest inland port in the world. But contrary to popular belief, Texas is not just an open range full of cowboys and horses, like many believe. In fact, Texas is a budding and modern urban metropolis. 82.5% of the population in Texas lives in metropolitan areas. Of the 10 most populated cities in the U.S., 3 are in Texas: Houston, Dallas, and San Antonio. Both the Houston metro area and the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex individually have more residents than the entire state of Arizona and 31 other states. Texas is home to more Fortune 500 companies than any other state and has no shortage of entertainment. Austin is considered the live music capital of the world, and there is no shortage of professional sports, shopping, art, and is home to some of the best universities and business schools in the nation. The population of Texas is 24 million, not including 16 million cattle. Texas has 215 cities with a population of 10,000 or more. As big as Texas is, believe it or not, it's getting even bigger. Texas has the largest population growth rate of any state and is growing by over 1,000 people a day. The Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex is the number one fastest growing metro area in the nation. In fact, the term Metroplex was originally coined and is uniquely used to describe the Dallas-Fort Worth area. It aptly names DFW's sprawling metropolitan area that contains several cities and their suburbs. Texas dominated the list of the nation's fastest growing cities: San Antonio, Fort Worth, Houston, Austin, and Dallas. All in the top 10. With this much growth in such a concentrated area, and 70% of the state's population living within 200 miles of Austin, it is now much more than a metroplex. We call it the Texaplex. 4 out of 5 Texans live in the Texaplex, and it is already home to 18 million people, and it's growing fast. Forecasts show that the Texaplex will add another 14 million people by 2030. That's the equivalent of adding to the current Texas population another Dallas-Fort Worth metropolitan area, another Houston metropolitan area, and another Austin metropolitan area. The Federal Reserve Bank has a word for it, but it can't be said with a Texan accent: megalopolis. We prefer Texaplex. So what is it that makes Texas so attractive? Low cost of living, stable and growing housing market, no state income tax, no state tax on goods in transit. Texas has ranked as the number one U.S. exporting state for 6 straight years. CNBC recently named Texas the number one state for doing business. In the past 5 years, Texas has created 1.2 million new jobs. In the last year, half of all jobs created in the U.S. were in Texas. Forbes' recent article, Best Cities to Buy a Home, features all 4 Texaplex cities in their top 10: Houston, Austin, San Antonio, Dallas-Fort Worth. Austin and San Antonio lead Forbes' list of best bang for the buck cities. Residents of both enjoy affordable housing and promising prospects for job growth in the coming years. Houston and Dallas also land in the top 10 at numbers 4 and 7 respectively. And the weather is nice. So what does all this mean for those who call the Lone Star State home? Opportunity. Opportunities for individuals, families, and businesses. More jobs, more commerce, and more real estate opportunities. The Texaplex offers explosive potential. It's going to be a Lone Star boom. Join the adventure. Let us help you find your way.
Okay, that was part one. The only thing that I'm going to say at this moment out of that is that Texas now is about 28 million people, which is roughly on par with if I have the updated figures of Australia, and we're just short of the total amount of people who live in Canada. And I will say this too: Texas is the only state in this country that could survive on its own without the rest of the United States, and the rest of the United States cannot survive without Texas. So let me play part two.
After years of gloomy headlines recounting economic turmoil, Texas continues to shine as a lone star. Let's take a closer look at why everyone is talking about Texas. Texas is big. If all 7 billion people on Earth moved to Texas, there would be more than 1,100 square feet for every man, woman, and child on the planet. That's 4.5% more space per person than what New York City dwellers are already used to. Texas is bigger than New England, New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Illinois, Puerto Rico, and Cuba combined. Austin, the 14th largest city in the country, is within 200 miles of four of the largest cities in the United States: Houston, San Antonio, and Dallas-Fort Worth. Together, these cities are a powerhouse. 80% of the state's population lives in the areas defined by these cities. We have a name for this enormous, globally recognized hotspot of innovation, opportunity, and growth. We call it the Texaplex. Speaking of size, the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport alone is larger than Manhattan. The University of Texas in Austin is the third largest landowner in the United States. The land area of San Antonio could contain New York City and Detroit with room to spare. The Houston metro area has more people than the entire population of Colorado and 34 other states. But as big as Texas is, it's getting even bigger. Four of the top 10 fastest-growing metro areas in the nation are in the Texaplex. In the 2010 census, Texas had over 25 million residents. But by 2030, Texas will grow to 40 million residents. It's like adding to the current Texas population an additional Dallas-Fort Worth metro area, an additional Houston metro area, and an additional Austin metro area. That's like unloading four jumbo jets every day for the next 19 years. So why is everyone so eager to move to Texas? One idea: jobs. In the last 10 years, Texas added 732,000 net jobs. No other state even tops 100,000. Nearly half of all new jobs since 2009 were created in Texas. But Texas has always had an entrepreneurial spirit. The world's largest operator of convenience stores, with over 39,000 outlets, started with one store in Texas in 1927. With no state income tax and no tax on goods in transit, it's no wonder Texas is home to over 50 Fortune 500 companies and has more Fortune 1000 companies than any other state. In Forbes' list of America's best cities for young professionals, Texaplex cities took 3 of the top 10. Texas isn't just growing, it's booming. If Texas were a country, it would have the 11th largest economy in the world. Its annual economic output exceeds $1 trillion, and that number is climbing. As the largest exporter of goods in the United States, Texas grosses more than $100 billion a year in trade with other nations.
and the center point of the economic growth in Texas is the Texaplex. For the second year in a row, Austin was number one in small business vitality. In addition to Austin's reputation as a high-tech center for semiconductors and software, it is also becoming a hub for pharmaceutical and biotechnology companies. Nearly 85 such companies already call Austin home. In Dallas-Fort Worth, there are two top-performing airports, DFW, the third largest airport in the world in terms of aircraft movement, and Dallas Love Field, home to the third largest airline in the world in terms of passengers carried. Dallas-Fort Worth is home to the fourth highest number of billionaires in the world. With more than 5,000 energy-related firms, Houston is known as the energy capital of the world. Houston is also home to Texas Medical Center, the largest medical center in the world. San Antonio's defense industry employs nearly 90,000 people, with an economic impact of more than $5 billion. The tourism industry in San Antonio is also booming. The city boasts 5 of the top 15 tourist attractions in Texas. The economy isn't the only reason people want to come to the Texaplex. Nearly 25% of the retail space in the nation's 525 major shopping centers is in Texas. ABC's The View ranked the San Marcos shopping mall as the third best shopping mall in the world. Dallas was home to the first self-contained shopping center in the country, and today has the most shopping malls per capita. Austin is known as the live music capital of the world, and is home to one of the largest and most important music and film festivals in the United States, South by Southwest. SeaWorld San Antonio is the world's largest marine life adventure park, and the Travel Channel rated San Antonio's Schlitterbahn as the world's best water park. Houston's Arts District has the second most theater seats in the country, behind only New York City. There's plenty of sports, too. There are 10 professional teams in the Texaplex, easily covering all the major American sports. The Texaplex is also home to some of the best colleges and universities in the nation. Forbes' list of best cities to buy a home features all four of the Texaplex metro areas. To rent a moving truck from Los Angeles to Houston costs nearly twice as much as the other direction. What does that tell you about supply and demand? The Texaplex is a hotbed of opportunity and growth. Its size, population, growth, economy, and culture are all excellent reasons to believe that even in the darkest times, Texas will continue to shine as a lone star. Texaplex is a production of David Winans and Madassic Marketing. For more about what makes Texas great, visit texaplex.com. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/texaplex.
Okay, again, I'll elaborate more on some of that stuff in the next show. There was a hell of a lot that was discussed there. So, anyway, I'm going to go ahead and end this show now. And I appreciate everyone listening. And be sure and catch next week for part 3. And we'll go out with some ZZ Top. Oh.
we keep running, you will lose your army.
Twenty-odd years ago, Napoleon returns from exile in Elba, puts together an army and moves east, swiftly, before an alliance of nations can occur. Wellington, with fewer men, fewer armaments, stays one step ahead of the French, teasing them with his presence, knowing that a large army will have to splinter to keep up. He moves and waits. Moves and waits for Napoleon to make a mistake, to fall into a scenario that condemns him to defeat. Wellington chooses a setting for victory. Before it exists for him, before he lays eyes on it, it has an open battleground, a sloping plain, cover for encampment, and an opportunity to flank the enemy. The Mexican army is splintered. And though they do not know it, Santa Anna's troops subsist on gasps of air and sips of hope. I share Wellington's battleground vision, though I do not know the name of the place that I imagine. I, sir, do not consider myself Wellington. Santa Anna, however, does consider himself to be the Napoleon of the West. We shall move and wait until he makes a mistake and presents us with his own Waterloo.
Teller.
Satan! Satan!